the stakes on the face of the embankment, then went to talk with Narayan. I told him, "We'll scout their camp now."
"Just us?"
His grin was forced. "You and me."
"Yes, mistress. Though I'd feel more comfortable if Sindhu accompanied us."
"Can he move quietly?" I couldn't picture that bulk sneaking anywhere.
"Like a mouse, mistress."
"Get him. Don't waste time. We'll need all the darkness we've got." Narayan gave me an odd look, took off. We left a password, crossed the creek. Narayan and Sindhu stole through the woods as though to stealth-born. Quieter than mice, they took our pickets by surprise. Those had seen nothing of the enemy.
"Awfully sure of themselves,"
Sindhu grumbled, the first I'd heard him volunteer an opinion.
"Maybe they're plain stupid. The Shadow Master's soldiers hadn't impressed me with anything but their numbers."
We spied their campfires before I expected them. They'd camped among the trees. I hadn't foreseen that possibility.
Damned inconsiderate of them.
Narayan touched my arm diffidently. Mouth to ear, he breathed,
"Sentries, wait here."
He stole forward like a ghost, returned like one.
"Two of them, sound asleep.
Walk carefully."
So we just strolled in to where I could see what I wanted. I studied the layout for several minutes. "Satisfied," I said.
"Let's go."
One of the sentries had wakened. He started up as Sindhu drifted past, firelight glistening off his broad, naked back. Narayan's hand darted to his waist. His arm whipped. His wrist snapped. A serpent of black cloth looped around the sentry's neck. Narayan strangled him so efficiently, his companion didn't waken. Sindhu took the other with a strip of scarlet cloth. Now I knew what peeked from their loincloths. Their weapons. They rearranged their victims so they looked like they were sleeping with their tongues out, all the while whispering cant that sounded ritualistic. I said, "Sindhu, stay and keep watch. Warn us if they discover the bodies. Narayan, come with me." I hurried as much as darkness allowed. Once we reached camp, I told Narayan,
"That was neatly done. I want to learn that trick with the cloth."
The notion surprised him. He didn't say anything. "Collect the 10 best squads. Arm them. Also the 20 men you think best able to handle horses. Ram!" Ram arrived as I began readying my armor. He grew troubled. "What's the matter now?" Then I saw what he'd done to my helmet. "What the hell is this? I told you to clean it, not destroy it." He was like a shy boy as he said,
"This apes one aspect of the goddess Kina, mistress. One of her names is Lifetaker. You see, in that avatar, her aspect is very like this armor."
"Next time, ask. Help me into this." 10 minutes later, I stood at the center of the group I'd had Narayan assemble. "We're going to attack them. The point isn't glory or victory. We just want to discourage them from attacking us. We're going in, we're doing a little damage, and then we're getting out." I described the encampment, gave assignments, drawing in the dirt beside a fire. "In and out. Don't waste time trying to kill them. Just hurt somebody. A dead man can be left where he falls, but a wounded man becomes a burden to his comrades. Whatever happens, don't go beyond the far edge of their camp. We'll retreat when they start getting organized. Grab any weapon you can. Ram, capture every horse you can. Everybody, if you can't grab weapons, grab food or tools. Nobody risk anybody's life trying to grab just one more thing. And lastly, be quiet. We're all dead if they hear us coming."
Narayan reported the dead sentry still undiscovered. I sent him forward to eliminate as many more as he and Sindhu could manage. I had the main party cover the last 200 yards in driblets. 120 men moving at once, no matter how they try, make noise. I looked into the camp. Men were stirring. Looked like it was near time to change the guard. Ram's bunch joined us. I donned my helmet, turned my back on my men, walked toward the only shelter in the camp. It would belong to the commander. I set the witch fires playing over me, unsheathed my sword. Fires ran out its blade. It was coming back. The few southerners awake gawked. The men poured into the camp, stabbed the sleeping, overwhelmed those who were awake. I struck a man down, reached the tent, hacked it apart as the man within reacted to the uproar. I wound up two-handed and struck off his head, grabbed it by the hair, held it high, turned to check the progress of the raid. The Southerners were making no effort to defend themselves. 200 must have died already. The rest were trying to get away. Could I have routed them so easily? Sindhu and Narayan came running, prostrated themselves, banged their heads on the ground, and gobbled at me in that cant they used. Crows fluttered through the trees, raucous. My men hurtled around, hacking and slashing, spending the wealth of fear they'd carried through the night. Narayan, see what the survivors are doing, quickly, before they mount a counterattack. Sindhu, help me control these men. Narayan ran off. He came back in a few minutes. They've started gathering a quarter mile down the road. They think a demon attacked them. They don't want to come back. Their officers are telling them they can't survive if they don't recover their camp and animals. That was true. Maybe another glimpse of the demon would encourage them to stay away. I got the men into a ragged line, advanced to the edge of the wood. Narayan and Sindhu sneaked ahead. I wanted warning if the Southerners were inclined to fight. I'd back off. They fled again. Narayan said they killed those officers who tried to rally them. Fortune smiles, I recall murmuring. I'd have to take a closer look at this demon Kina. She must have some reputation. I wondered why I'd never heard of her. I withdrew to the captured encampment. We'd come into a lot of useful material. Ram, get the rest of the band. Have them bring the stakes from the embankment. Narayan, think about which men are least deserving of receiving arms. There would be enough to go around now, almost. Arms would be a trust and honor to be earned. The change was dramatic. You'd have thought it was another Goja triumph. Even those who hadn't participated gained confidence. I saw it everywhere. These men had a new feeling of self-worth. They were proud to be part of a desperate enterprise, and they gave me my due place in it. I walked through the camp, dropping hints that soon they would be part of something with power. That had to be nurtured and continually fertilized with suspicion and distrust of everyone outside the band. It takes time to forge a hammer. More time than I would get, probably. It takes years, even decades, to create a force like the Black Company, which had been carried forward on the crest of a wave of tradition. Here I was trying to magic up a golden hammer, something gaudy but with no real substance, deadly only to the ignorant and unprepared. It was time for a ceremony alienating them from the rest of the world. Time for a blood rite that would bind them to one another and me. I had the stakes from the embankment planted along the road south of the wood. Then I had all the dead Southerners decapitated and their heads placed atop the stakes, facing southward, ostensibly warning travelers who shared their ambitions. Narayan and Sindhu were delighted. They hacked off heads with great enthusiasm. No horror touched them. None touched me either. I'd seen everything in my time. Chapter 10 Swan lay in the shade on the bank of the main, lazily watching his bobber float on a still deep pool. The air was warm, the shade was cool. The bugs were too lazy to bother him. He was half asleep. What more could a man ask? Blade sat down.
Catch anything?
Nope. Don't know what I'd do if I did. What's up?
The woman wants us.
He meant the Radisha, whom they had found waiting when they'd reached Goja, much to Smoke's dismay.
She's got a job for us.
Don't she always? You tell her to stick it in her ear?
Thought I'd save you that pleasure.
I'd rather you'd save me the walk. I'm comfortable.
She wants us to drag Smoke somewhere he don't want to go.
Why didn't you say so?
Swan pulled his line out of the water. There was no bait on his hook.
And I thought there weren't any fish in that creek.
He left his pole against a tree, a statement of sorts. Where's Cordy?
Probably there waiting. He was watching Ja. I told him already.
Swan looked across the river.
I'd kill for a pint of beer.
They'd been in the brewery business in Taglios before the excitement swept them up. Blade snorted, headed for the fortress overlooking Goja Ford. The fort stood on the south bank of the main, It had been built by the Shadow Masters after their invasion of Taglios had been repulsed to defend their conquests south of the river. The fortress had been overwhelmed by the Black Company after the victory north of the river. Taglian artisans were reinforcing it and beginning a companion fortress on the north bank. Swan scanned the Scabrous encampment west of the fortress. 800 men lived there. Some were construction workers. Most were fugitives from the south. One large group particularly irked him.
"Think Ja has figured out that the woman is here?"
Jahamaraj Ja was a powerful, hungry Shadar priest. He had commanded the mounted auxiliaries during the southern expedition. His flight north had been so precipitous he'd beaten Swan's party to the ford by several days.
"I think he's guessed. He tried to sneak a messenger across last night."
The Radisha, through Swan, had forbidden anyone to cross the river. She didn't want news of the disaster reaching Taglios before its dimensions were known.
"Messenger drowned. Cordy says Jaw thinks he made it."
Blade chuckled wickedly. He hated priests. Baiting them was his favorite sport. All priests of whatever faith.
"Good. That'll keep him out of our hair till we figure out what to do with him."
"I know what to do."
"Political consequences," Swan cautioned. "That your solution to everything? Cut somebody's throat?"
"Always slows them down."
The guards at the fortress gate saluted. They were favorites of the Radisha, and though neither Blade nor Swan nor Mather wanted it, they commanded Taglios's defenses now. Swan said,
"I got to learn to think in the long term, Blade. Never thought we'd be back at this after the Black Company showed."
"You got a lot to learn, Willow."
Cordy and Smoke waited outside the room where the Radisha holed up. Smoke looked like he had a bad stomach, like he'd make a run for it if he got a chance. Swan said,
"You're looking grim, Cordy."
"Just tired, mostly of playing with the runt."
Swan raised an eyebrow. Cordy was the calm one, the patient guy, the one who poured oil on the waters. Smoke must have provoked him good.
"She ready?"
"Whenever."
"Let's do it. I got a river full of fish waiting."
"Better figure on them getting gray hair before you get back."
Mather knocked, pushed the wizard ahead of him. The Radisha entered the room from the side as Swan closed the door. Here in private, with men not from her own culture, she didn't pretend to a traditional sex role.
"Did you tell them, Cordy?"
Willow exchanged glances with Blade, their old buddy on a nickname basis with the woman. Interesting. What did he call her? She didn't look like a Cuddles.
"Not yet."
"What's up?"
Swan asked.
The Radisha said, "I've had my men mixing with the soldiers. They've heard rumors that the woman who was the lieutenant of the Black Company survived. She's trying to pull the survivors together south of here."
"Best news I've heard in a while," Swan said.
He winked at Blade.
"Is it?"
"I thought it was a crying shame to lose such a resource."
"I'll bet. You have a low mind, Swan."
"Guilty. Hard not to once you've had a gander at her. So she made it. Great. Gets us three off the hook. Gives you a professional to carry on."
"That remains to be seen. There'll be difficulties. Cordy, tell them."
20-some men from the second just came in. They'd stayed off the road to avoid the Shadow Master's patrols. About 70 miles south of here, they took a couple prisoners. The night before our guys grabbed them, Kina and a ghost army supposedly attacked their camp and killed most of them."
Swan looked at Blade, at the Radisha, at Cordy again.
"I missed something. Who's Kina? And what's got into Smoke?"
The wizard was shaking like somebody had dunked him in ice water. Mather and Blade shrugged. They didn't know. The Radisha sat down.
"Get comfortable."
She chewed her lip.
"This will be difficult to tell."
"Then just go straight at it," Swan said.
"Yes, I suppose."
The Radisha collected herself.
"Kina is the fourth side of the Taglian religious triangle. She belongs to none of the pantheons but terrifies everybody. She isn't named, lest naming invoke her. She's very unpleasant. Fortunately, her cult is small and proscribed. Membership is punishable by death. The penalty is deserved. The cult's rites always involve torture and murder. Even so, it persists. Its members awaiting someone called the Foretold in the Year of the Skulls.
It's an old, dark religion that knows no national or ethnic bounds. Its members hide behind masks of respectability. They sometimes call themselves the Deceivers. They live normal lives among the rest of the community. Anyone could belong. Few of the common people know they exist anymore. Swan didn't get it and said so.
Don't sound much different from the Shadar Hada or Kadi avatars.
The Radisha smiled grimly.
Those are ghosts of the reality.
Hada and Kadi were two aspects of the Shadar death god.
Ja could show you 1,000 ways Kadi is a kitten compared to Kina.
Jaha Maharaj Ja was a devotee of Kadi. Swan shrugged, doubting he could tell the difference if they drew pictures. He'd given up trying to understand the welter of Taglian gods, each with his or her 10 or 20 different aspects and avatars. He indicated smoke.
What's with him? He shakes any more, we'll have to change his diaper.
Smoke predicted a year of skulls, a time of chaos and bloodshed, if we employed the Black Company. He didn't believe it would come. He just wanted to scare my brother out of doing something that scared him, but he's on record as having predicted it. Now there's a chance it might come.
Sure, come on. Swan frowned, still lost. Let me get this straight. There's a death cult around that makes Ja and his Kadi freaks look like a bunch of Nancy boys? That scares the guano out of anybody who knows who they are?
Yes.
And they worship a goddess named Kina.
That is the most common of many names.
Why aren't I surprised? Is there any god down here without more aliases than a 200-year-old con man?
Kina is the name given her by the Guni. She has been called Patwa, Kompara, Bomana, and other names. The Guni, the Shadar, the Vedna, all find ways to accept her into their belief systems. Many Shadar who become her followers, for example, take her to be the true form of Hada or Kadi, who is just one of her deceits.
Gah! All right, I'll bite. There's a badass in the weeds called Kina. So how come me and Cordy and Blade never heard of her before?
The Radisha appeared mildly embarrassed.
You were shielded. You're outsiders. From the North.
Maybe so.
What did the North have to do with it?
But why the panic? One garbled thing about this Kina from a prisoner who's got no reason to tell the truth, and smoke goes to wetting his pants, and you start foaming at the mouth. I got a little trouble taking you serious.
Point taken. You shouldn't have been shielded. I'm sending you to check out the story.
Swan grinned. He had a lever.
Not without you stop jacking us around. Tell us the whole story. Bad enough you messed with the Black Company. You think you're going to mess us around because we weren't born in Taglios?
Enough, Swan.
The Radisha wasn't pleased. Smoke made a whining noise. He shook his head.
What's with him?
Willow demanded. Much more of that weirdness, and he was going to strangle the old guy.
Smoke sees a ghost in every shadow. In your case, he's afraid your spy sent ahead by the Black Company.
Sure, moron. That's another thing. How come everybody is so damn twitchy about those guys? They maybe kicked ass around here heading north, but that was back at the dawn of time, practically. 400 years ago.
The Radisha ignored that.
Kina's antecedents are uncertain. She's a foreign goddess. The legends say a prince of shadow tricked the most handsome of the lords of light out of his physical aspect for a year. While he wore that, he seduced Mahi, goddess of love, and sired Kina on her. Kina grew up more beautiful than her mother, but empty, without a soul, without love or compassion, but hungry to possess them. Her hunger couldn't be satisfied. She preyed upon men and gods alike, shadow and light. Among her names are Eater of Souls and Vampire Goddess. She so weakened the Lords of Light that the Shadows thought to conquer them and sent a horde of demons against them. The Lords of Light were so oppressed they begged Kina for help. She did help, though why she did isn't explained. She met the demons in battle, overthrew them, and devoured them and all their wickedness.
The Radisha paused a moment. Then,
Kina became much worse than she had been, gaining the names Devourer, Destroyer, Destructor. She became a force beyond the gods, outside the balance of light and shadow, enemy of all. She became a terror so great, light and shadow joined forces against her.
Her father himself tricked her into falling into an enchanted sleep. Blade muttered,
"Makes as much sense as the story of any other god, meaning it don't."
Squeaking, Smoke said,
"Kina is a personification of that force some call entropy."
To the Radisha,
"Correct me if I'm wrong."
The Radisha ignored him. Before Kina fell asleep, she realized she'd been tricked. She took a huge breath, exhaled a minute fraction of her soul essence, no more than a ghost of a ghost. That specter wanders the world in search of living vessels it can possess and use to bring on the Year of the Skulls. If that avatar can free enough souls and cause enough pain, Kina can be wakened. Swan chuckled like an old woman scolding.
"You believe any of that stuff?"
"What I believe doesn't matter, Swan. The deceivers believe. If the rumor spreads that Kina has been seen, and there's any evidence to support it, they'll preach a crusade of murder and torture."
"Wait!"
She raised a hand. "The Taglian people are ripe for an outburst of violence. By damming the normal discharge for generations, they've created a reservoir of potential violence. The deceivers would like that to explode, to bring on the Year of the Skulls. My brother and I would prefer to harness and direct that ferocity." Blade grumbled about the absurdities of the theological imagination and why didn't people have enough sense to smother would-be priests in their cradles. The Radisha said,
"We don't think the deceivers have a formal, hierarchical priesthood. They seem to form loose bands or companies under an elected captain. The captain appoints a priest, an omen reader, and so forth. His authority is limited. He has little influence outside his band unless he's done something to gain a reputation."
Blade said,
"They don't sound so bad to me."
The Radisha scowled. "The main qualification of a priest seems to be education and probity toward his own kind. The bands indulge in crimes of all sorts. Once a year they share out their spoils according to the priest's estimation of the members' contributions toward the glory of Kina. To support his decisions, in the event of dispute, the priest keeps a detailed chronicle of the band's activities."
"Fine and dandy," Swan said. "But how about we get to what you want us to do? We supposed to drag Smoke around to see if we can sniff out what really happened to the Shadow Master's soldiers?"
"Yes."
"Why bother?"
"I thought I just explained."
The Radisha controlled herself. "If that was a true apparition of Kina, we have bigger troubles than we thought. The Shadow Masters may be the lesser half."
"I warned you!" Smoke squealed. "I warned you 100 times, but you wouldn't listen. You had to bargain with devils."
"Shut up."
The Radisha glared. "I'm as tired of you as Swan is. Go find out what happened, and learn what you can about the woman lady, too."
"I can handle that," Swan said, grinning. "Come on, old buddy."
He grabbed Smoke's shoulder. He asked the Radisha,
"Think you can manage Jahamaraj Ja without us?"
"I can manage him."
Mounted, ready to ride, waiting for Blade and Smoke, Swan asked,
"Cordy, you get the feeling you're out in the woods in the middle of the night and everybody's doing their damnedest to hide the light?"
Mather was more the thinker than Willow or Blade.
"They're afraid if we know the whole story, we'll desert.
They're desperate. They've lost the Black Company. We're all that's left."
"Like the old days."
The old days, before the coming of the professionals, when their adopted homeland had made them reluctant captains because the feuding cults couldn't tolerate taking orders from native non-believers. A year in the field, playing blind lead the blind, overcoming political shenanigans daily, had convinced Swan that Blade had a point, that it wouldn't hurt the world a bit if you rid it of a few 100,000 selected priests.
"You buy that Kina stuff?"
I don't think she told any lies. She just forgot to tell the whole truth.
"Maybe when we get Smoke out there, 40 miles from nowhere, we can squeeze it out of him."
"Maybe, as long as we don't forget what he is.
We scare him too much, and he's liable to show us what kind of wizard he is. Button it, they're coming."
Smoke looked like he was headed for the gallows. Blade looked as unhappy as ever. But Swan knew he was pleased. Blade figured he was going to get a chance to kick some deserving asses. Chapter 11. The wounded man thought he was trapped in a drug dream. He'd been a physician. He knew drugs did strange things to the mind. Dreams were strange enough. He couldn't wake up. Some fractured shard of rationality lodged in a corner of his brain, watched, sensed, wondered vaguely as he drifted eternally a few feet above a landscape he seldom saw. Sometimes branches passed overhead. Sometimes there were hills in the corners of his eyes. Once he wakened while drifting through tall grass. Once he felt he was passing over a broad expanse of water. Occasionally, a black horse looked down at him. He thought he knew the beast, but couldn't assemble the pieces in his mind. Sometimes a figure in shapeless robing bestrode the beast, stared down out of an empty cowl. These things were all real, he suspected, but they fell into no meaningful pattern. Only the horse seemed familiar. Hell, he couldn't recall who he was. His thoughts wouldn't sequence. Probable pasts kept intruding on the apparent now, often as real. Those intrusions were shards of battle, uncertain on the jagged edges, bright as blood in the center. Great slaughters all. Sometimes names attached themselves. Lords, Charm, Beryl, Roses, Horse, Dejagore, Juniper, the Barrowland, Queensbridge. Dejagore again. Dejagore often. Infrequently he recalled a face. The woman had marvelous blue eyes, long black hair, and always wore black. She must have been important to him. Yes, the only woman. Whenever she appeared, she vanished again in moments, replaced by the faces of men. Unlike the bloodlettings, he could put no names to them. Yet he had known them. He felt they were ghosts, waiting to welcome him among them. Occasionally, pain consumed his chest. He was his most alert when it was most intense. The world almost made sense then. But the creature in black would come, and he would tumble back amongst the dreams. Was the black companion death? Was this his passage to the nether realm? His mind wouldn't function well enough to examine the proposition. He hadn't been religious. He'd believed that death was it. When you died, you were dead, like a squished bug or drowned rat, and your immortality was in the minds of those you left behind. He slept far more than he was awake. Thus time eluded him. He experienced a moment of profound déjà vu as he passed beneath a solitary, half-dead tree, shortly before entering a dark wood. That tree had been important somehow. Sometime. He drifted through the wood, out, across a clearing, in through the entrance of a building. It was dark inside. A lamp found life at the edge of his vision. He descended, a flat surface pressed against his back. The figure in black came, bent over him. A hand concealed in a black glove touched him. Consciousness fled. He awakened ravenous. A lance of agony bored through his chest, throbbed. He was drenched in his own sweat. His head ached, felt as though it was stuffed with sodden cotton. He was running a fever. His mind worked well enough to catalog symptoms and conclude that he had been wounded and was suffering from a severe cold. That could be a lethal combination. Memories came tumbling back like a rowdy litter of kittens, all over one another, not making much sense. He'd led 40,000 men into battle outside Dejagore. It hadn't gone well. He'd been trying to rally the troops. An arrow out of nowhere had driven through his breastplate and chest, miraculously finding nothing vital. He'd fallen. His standard-bearer had donned his armor, trying to turn the tide with a valiant fiction. Obviously, Mergen had failed. He made a strangling sound through a desert throat. The figure in black appeared. Now he remembered. It had dogged the Black Company down the length of the world, accompanied by a horde of crows. He tried to sit up. The pain was too much for him. He was too weak. He knew this dread thing. It came out of nowhere, a lightning bolt, but it was conviction. Soul Catcher! The impossible. The dead walking. Soul Catcher. One-time mentor. One-time mistress of the Black Company. More recently, a deadly enemy, but still long ago. supposedly dead for a decade and a half. He'd been there. He'd seen her slain. He'd helped hunt her down. He tried to rise again, some vague force driving him to fight the unfightable. A gloved hand stayed him. A gentle voice told him, "Don't strain yourself. You aren't healing well. You haven't been eating or taking enough fluids. Are you awake? Are you sensible?" He managed a feeble nod. "Good. I'm going to prop you up in a slightly elevated position. I'm going to feed you broth. Don't waste energy. Let your strength come back." She propped him, had him sip through a reed. He downed a pint of broth and kept it down. Soon a glimmer of strength trickled through his flesh. "That's enough for now. Now we'll get you cleaned up." He was a disgusting mess.
"How long?"
he croaked. She placed a pot of water in his hands, inserted another reed. "Sip. Don't talk." She started cutting his clothing off him.
"It's been 7 days since you were hit, Croaker."
Her voice had become another voice entirely. It changed every time she paused. This voice was masculine, mocking, though he wasn't the mockery's object.
"Your comrades still control Deja Gore, to the embarrassment of the Shadow Masters. Your Mogaba is in command."
He's stubborn, but he could be embarrassed himself. And however stubborn he is, he can't hold out forever. The powers ranged against him are too great. He tried to ask a question. She forestalled him. The mocking voice asked,
"Her?" Wicked chuckle. "Yes, she survived. There'd be no point to this if she hadn't."
A new voice, female, but as hard as a diamond arrow point, snarled.
"She tried to kill me. Ha ha! Yes, you were there, my love. You helped. But I don't hold a grudge. You were under her spell. You didn't know what you were doing. You'll redeem yourself by helping me take my revenge."
The man didn't respond. She bathed him. She was free with the water. He'd been diminished by his wound, but he was still a big man, 4 inches over 6 feet tall. He was about 45 years old. His hair was an average, unnoteworthy brown. He'd begun to go bald in front. His eyes were hard, humorless, icy blue, narrow, and deeply set. He had a ragged graying beard surrounding a thin-lipped mouth that seldom smiled. His face bore scattered reminders of a childhood pox and more than a few memories of acne. He might have been moderately good-looking once. Time had been unkind. Even in repose, his face looked hard and a little off-center. He didn't look like what he had been all his adult life, the Black Company's historian and physician. His appearance was more suited to the role he had inherited, that of captain. He described himself as looking like a child molester waiting for a chance to strike. He wasn't comfortable with his appearance. Soulcatcher scrubbed him with a vigor that recalled his mother's.
"Don't take the skin off."
"Your wound is healing slowly. You'll have to tell me what I did wrong." She'd never been a healer. She was a destroyer. Croaker was puzzled by her interest. He wasn't valuable. What was he? Just a dinged-up old mercenary, alive well beyond the expectations of his kind. He squeaked a question. She laughed, voice filled with childlike delight.
"Vengeance, dear. A simple, gentle, guileful vengeance. And I won't lay a hand on her. I'll let her do it to herself."
She patted his cheek, drew a finger along the line of his jaw.
"It took a while, but I knew the moment was inevitable. Fated. The consummation, the exchange of the magic, deadly three words. Fated. I sensed it before you met."
Again the childlike laughter.
"She was an age finding something so precious. My vengeance will be to take it away."
Croaker closed his eyes. He could not yet reason closely. He understood only that he was in no immediate danger. The plot was easily voided. He would become a tool of no value. Broken. He put it out of mind. First, he had to heal. Time enough later to do what had to be done. More laughter. This from a woman adult and knowing.
"Remember when we campaigned together, Croaker? The trick we played on Raker?
The fun we had tormenting Limper? He grunted. He remembered. Everything but the fun. Remember how you always thought I could read your mind? He remembered that, and the terror it had inspired. That old fear crept back. You do remember, she laughed again. I'm so glad. We're going to have such fun. The whole world thinks we're dead. You can get away with anything when you're dead. Her laugh gained an edge of madness. We'll haunt them, Croaker. That's what we'll do. He regained enough strength to walk. With help. His captor made him walk, forced him to gain strength. But still, he slept most of the time, and dreamed terrible dreams when he did. The place anchored the dreams. He didn't know that. His dreams told him it wasn't a good place, that the very trees and earth and stone remembered evils done there. He felt they were true dreams, but found no supporting evidence while he was awake. Unless he counted the ominous crows. Always there were the crows, tens and hundreds and thousands of crows. Standing in the doorway to their shelter, a half-ruined stone structure buried in vegetation in the heart of a dark wood, he asked,
"What is this place? The wood where I chased you a few months ago?"
"Yes, it's the holy grove of those who worship Kena. If we cleared the creepers, you could see carved representations. Once it was important to the Black Company, who took it from the Shadar. The ground is filled with bones." He turned slowly, looked into her empty cowl. He wouldn't look at the box she carried. He knew what must be in it.
"The Black Company?"
"They made sacrifices here. 100,000 prisoners of war." Croaker blanched. That wasn't something he wanted to hear. He had a long romance with the history of the company. There was no place in that for a wicked pass.
"Truth?"
"Truth, my love. I've seen the books the wizard Smoke concealed from you in Taglios. They include the missing volumes of your annals. Your forebears were cruel men. Their mission required the sacrifice of 1,000,000 souls." His stomach nodded.
"To what? To whom? Why?"
She hesitated. He knew she wasn't being honest when she said, "Well, that wasn't clear. Your Lieutenant Mogaba might know, though." It wasn't what she said, but the way she said it. The voice she used. He shuddered. And he believed. Mogaba had been strange and secretive throughout his association with the company. What was he doing to the company's traditions now? "Kina's disciples come here twice a year. Their Festival of Lights comes in a month. We have to finish before then." Troubled, Croaker asked,
"Why are we here?"
"We're recovering our health," she laughed. "Where we won't be bothered. Everyone shuns this place. Once I've nursed you back, you're going to help me." Still amused, she pushed back her cowl. She had no head. She lifted that box she always carried, a battered thing, a foot to a side, opened a little door. A face looked out. It was a beautiful face, like the face of his lover, though less careworn and lacking life's animation. Impossible. His stomach knotted again. He recalled the day that head had been struck from its body, to lie in the dust staring up at him and Lady, her sister. It had been a blow well earned. Soulcatcher had betrayed the Lady. Soulcatcher had meant to supplant her sister as ruler of the Empire.
"I can't do anything like that."
"Of course you can. And you will. Because it will keep both of you alive. We all want to live, don't we? I want her to live because I want her to hurt. I want to live because I want to watch her hurt. You want to live because of her. Because you revere the company. Because..." Gentle laughter. "Because where there's life, there's hope." Chapter 12. Thunder stampeded. Silver lightning lashed the wine-dark clouds, cracked the umber sky. A mold gray horde howled across a basalt plain toward the golden chariots of the gods. A figure stepped from the line, 10 feet tall, polished ebony, naked, lifting each foot knee-high to the side, then swinging the leg forward and stamping down. The earth shook. The figure was female, perfection, but hairless, wore a girdle of children's skulls. Her face was protean, one moment radiant, dark beauty, the next a nightmare of burning eyes and vampire fangs. The figure seized a demon and devoured him, rending, tearing, flinging entrails. Demon blood spurted and sprayed. It burned holes in the face of the plane. The figure's jaws distended. She swallowed the demon's head whole. A lump ran down her neck like a mouse bulging a snake's throat. The horde beset her, and could do her no harm. She devoured another screaming devil, then another, and another. With each she grew and waxed more terrible. "I am here, daughter. Open to me. I am your dream. I am power." The voice floated like a gossamer in golden caverns where old men sat beside the way, frozen in time, immortal, unable to move an eyelid. Mad, some covered by fairy webs of ice, as though a thousand spiders had spun with threads of frozen water. Above, an enchanted forest of icicles hung from the cavern roof. "Come, I am what you seek. You are my child." But the footing was treacherous, making it impossible to advance or retreat. The voice called, summoned, with infinite patience. This time I remembered both dreams when I wakened. I still shivered with the chill of those caverns. The dream was very different every time, I thought, and yet was the same. A summoning. I'm not stupid. I've seen enough incredibilities to know the dreams were more than nightmares. Something had singled me out. Something was trying to recruit me. To what cause, I couldn't yet guess. The method was ancient. I've used it 1,000 times. Offer power, wealth, whatever the desire is. Dangling the lure till the fish bites, never revealing the cost. Did this thing know me? Unlikely. I was receptive, so it was trying to pull me. I wouldn't accept it as a god, though it might want to be thought one. I've met only one god. Old Father Tree, master of the plane of fear. And he's no god in the accepted sense, only a being of immense longevity and power. This world has shown me just 2 beings stronger than I. My husband, the Dominator, whom I cast into oblivion. In 1,000 years he may be remembered as a dark god. And Father Tree, greater than ever I could have been, who has roots anchoring him. He can project his power outside the plane of fear only through his servants. Croker told me about a 3rd power that lies buried under Father Tree, imprisoned while the tree survives. The tree is immortal by human standards. Where there are 3 great powers, there could be more. The world is old. Yesterday is shrouded. Those who become great in 1 age often do so by mining the secrets of ages past. Who knows how many great evils lie beneath this haunted earth? Who knows but what the gods of all men in all ages are, but echoes of those who followed a path like mine, and have, nevertheless, fallen victim to implacable time? Not a thought to soothe the soul. Time is the enemy whose patience can't be exhausted.
"Mistress, are you troubled?"
Narion's grin was absent. He showed genuine concern. "Oh." He'd come up quietly. "No, a bad dream that lingered. Nightmares are the coin we pay for doing what we have to do." He looked at me oddly. "Do you have nightmares, Narion?" I began to press him quietly, to weigh his answers to questions probing his flanks.
"Never, mistress. I sleep like a baby."
He turned slowly, surveyed the camp. The countryside was shrouded in mist.
"What's the agenda today?"
"Do we have practice weapons enough for a mock combat? 1 battalion against the other? I had enough men to field 2 battalions of 400 men, with a few hundred left to carry out camp duties and provide 1 inept cavalry troop.
"Barely. You want that?"
"I'd like to, but how can we reward the victors?" Training involved competitions now, with rewards for winning and for effort. Superior effort, even in losing, deserves recognition. Recognition encourages soldiers to give their best.
"There's relief from fatigues, foraging, and sentry duty."
"That's a possibility." I was also considering letting individuals send for their wives after we moved to Goja. Ram brought me a breakfast bowl. We weren't eating well, but we were getting bulk enough, so far. Narayan asked,
How much longer can you stall here?
Not long. Time was turning against us. The existence of the band had to be known up north. Potential political enemies would be digging in. Instead of mock combat, we'll have a review. Spread a rumor that I'm thinking of moving out if what I see pleases me. That ought to motivate them.
Yes, mistress.
Narayan retreated. He gathered his cronies, a dozen men who showed snips of colored cloth at their waists. An interesting group. They sprang from all three major religions, two minor cults, and from among the liberated foreign slaves. They pretty much ran the camp, though only Narayan and Ram had official standing. They kept the peace. The men weren't quite sure how to take them, but responded seriously because of that aura of the sinister that I'd noted myself. Narayan admitted nothing. He handled my probes deftly. There was no doubt he directed the dozen, though several sprang from higher castes. I kept an eye on him. Time would betray him, if he didn't open up, as he hinted he might. For the moment, he was too useful to press. I nodded approval.
They almost look like soldiers.
We'd have to get them uniform dress. Narayan nodded. He seemed smug, as though his genius had produced our triumph and sparked a renascent spirit. How are the riding lessons coming? Just making talk, I knew. Abysmally. None of these clowns belonged to a caste that got closer to a horse than to trail along behind, cleaning up. But damn, it would be a sin to waste those mounts.
Poorly, though a few men show promise, not including myself or Ram. We were born to walk.
Show promise had become his favorite expression, in reference to everything. As he taught me to use the strangler's kerchief, or rumal, at my insistence, he said I showed promise. I suspected he was surprised at how easily I picked it up. Its manipulation came as naturally as breathing, as though it was a skill I'd had all along. Maybe it came of centuries of practice at the quick, subtle gestures needed to manipulate sorceries.
"You were saying you were going to move?"
Narayan asked.
"Mistress?"
The honorific was becoming an afterthought. Narayan remained Taglian. He was beginning to take me for granted. "Our foragers are having to range pretty far." Narayan didn't reply, but seemed reluctant to go. I had a feeling I was being watched. At first I credited it to the crows. They kept me uncomfortable. Now I understood Croker's reaction better. They didn't behave the way crows ought. I'd mentioned them to Narayan. He'd grinned and called them a good omen, meaning they were a bad omen for someone else. I scanned our surroundings. The crows were there, in their scores, but... Narayan, collect the dozen best horsemen. I'm taking a patrol out.
But do you think...
How could I get through? I'm no garden rose. I'm taking a patrol out.
As you command, mistress, so shall it be.
It had better, Narayan. It had better. Chapter 13 Swan glanced at Blade. The black man's attitude towards smoke had grown from disdain into contempt. The wizard had no more spine than a worm. He shook like a leaf. Cordy said,
That's her.
Swan nodded. He grinned but kept his thoughts to himself.
She's putting something together. That gang is more organized than any I've seen down here.
They backed off the knoll from which they'd been watching the camp. Blade said,
We going to drop in?
He had hold of the wizard's sleeve like he expected the runt to run.
Not yet. I want to circle around. Check it out down south. Shouldn't be that far to where they hit the Shadowmaster's men. I want to see the place, if we can find it.
Cordy asked,
Think they know we're here?
What?
The idea startled Swan.
You said they're organized. Nobody ever accused the lady of not being efficient. She should have pickets out.
Swan thought. No one had entered or left the camp, but Mather had a point. If they wanted to remain unnoticed, they'd better move on.
You're right. Let's go. Blade, you were down here before. Know how to cross that creek somewhere that's not too far out of the way?
Blade nodded. In those desperate days before the Black Company picked up the reins, he'd led guerrillas behind the Shadow Master's main forces.
Lead on, Smoke, old buddy. I wish I could get a peek inside your head. I never seen anybody so ready to drizzle down his leg.
The wizard said nothing. Blade found a game ford 3 miles east of the South Road, led the way through woods, narrower than Swan expected. When they reached the southern side, Blade said,
"Road's 2 miles that way."
I figured. The sky was dark with buzzards. That's where we'll find our dead men. That was the place. The air was still. The stench hung like a poisonous miasma. Neither Swan nor Mather had a stomach strong enough to let them take a close look. Blade, though, seemed to have no sense of smell. He returned. Swan said,
"You look green around the gills."
"Not much but bones left. Been a while. 200, 300 men. Hard to tell now. Animals been at them? One thing. No heads."
"Eh?"
"No heads. Somebody cut them off."
Smoke moaned, then chucked his breakfast. His mount shied.
"No heads?" Swan asked. "I don't get it."
Mather said, "I've got an idea. Come on." He rode south, toward where crows circled, dipped, and squabbled. They found the heads. Blade asked,
"Want to get a count?"
He chuckled.
"No, let's drop in on our friends."
Smoke made protesting noises. Cordy asked,
"You still hot to trot with your proud beauty?"
Swan couldn't think of a flip answer.
"Maybe I'm starting to see Smoke's viewpoint. Don't let me get on her bad side."
Blade said,
"Only a mile to their camp straight up the road."
Swan snorted.
"We'll go around, thank you."
After they crossed the game ford, Mather suggested,
"Suppose we go up the road a ways and come down like we don't know nothing about back there. See what they say if they think we just rode in."
"Stop whining, Smoke,"
Swan said.
"Go with it. You got no choice. You're right, Cordy. It'll give us a clue if she's going to play games."
They rode north till they were behind a rise, turned west to the road, then turned south. They were almost back to the crest when Mather, in the lead, yelled,
"Yo! Look out!"
Chapter 14.
We crossed the creek into the wood, walking our mounts behind Sindhu, who had scouted till he knew every leaf and twig of the surrounding terrain. He led us along a meandering game trail which paralleled the creek going westward. I wondered what had become of the game. We hadn't seen anything bigger than a squirrel. A few native deer might have eased the food problem, though neither Guni nor Shadar touch meat. It was a long walk. My companions grumbled and bickered. The watching presence centered on a grove on a knoll whence it would be possible to observe events in our camp. I'd lapsed. I'd been thinking too far ahead. If I'd had the sense of a goose, I'd have had a squad posted there. The outlying pickets were too scattered to spot everything moving in the area, even if people weren't sneaking around. Fugitives slipped through all the time. They left their traces. I had a good idea what I'd find on that knoll. Somebody from up north who'd heard rumors and had gotten worried that I might be trouble. I meant to be a lot, for the Shadow Masters and anybody who got between us. We crossed the creek a few miles downstream, out of sight of the knoll, moved back to the east, and discovered that there was no way to approach the grove unseen the last third of a mile.
I told the men, "All we can do is ride straight at it. Let's do it without getting in a hurry. Maybe they won't run till we're so close they can't get away."
I didn't know if they could control themselves. The excitement had them again. They were pumped up, scared and eager.
"Let's go."
We'd covered half the open ground when the watchers flushed like quail.
"Shadar,"
somebody noted.
"Yes, mounted Shadar in uniform, cavalry equipped."
"Jahamaraj Shah's men!" I snapped. The men cursed, even those who were Shadar. Jah was the leading Shadar priest in Taglios.
Croker's doing.
Jah's concession to his debt hadn't lasted through the fighting at Dejagore. He and his cavalry had abandoned the field while the outcome was in question. Most of the men had seen them run, or had heard.
I'd been pushing the idea that the battle would have been ours had Ja stood his ground. It could be true. Ja had contributed nothing when a feather's weight might have tilted the balance. I thought he'd run because he'd suffered an opportunistic flash. He'd intuited that the battle would go poorly and had decided to beat everybody home. He'd played a strong hand there because he'd be the only man with a military force, however inept, to back him up. He deserved some special thought now. I didn't have to order a chase. There were 5 Shadar. Their flight was proof they were Blackhearts. The men rode with blood in their eyes. Unfortunately, the Shadar were better riders. I did want to talk to them. I urged my stallion to his best pace and closed up fast. No everyday mount stood a chance against him. The Shadar hit the north road. As I nosed up on the most laggardly, the leader swept over the crest and collided with riders headed south. Horses shied. Men yelled. Riders came unhorsed. I circled a Shadar who regained his feet and tried to run. He'd lost his helmet. I grabbed him by the hair, ran him 50 yards before turning to examine the victims of the collision. Well, Swan, Mather, and Blade. And that sneaking twit of a hedge wizard, Smoke. What now? Mather, Smoke, and Blade had kept their seats. Swan was on the ground, groaning and swearing. He got up, swore some more, kicked a fallen Shadar, looked around for his horse. Smoke was rattled right down to his ankles. He had no color left, was whispering some sort of prayer. Mather and Blade ignored Swan's histrionics. I presumed that meant he wasn't hurt. My captive tried to get away. I ran him a few yards, let him loose when the horse was moving faster than he could keep up. He flung forward, slid on his face, stopped at Swan's feet. Swan sat down on him. I asked Mather, "What are you doing here?" He was the only one of the bunch who made straight sense. "The Radisha sent us. Wants to know what's happening down here. There have been rumors. Some say you're alive. Some say dead." "I'm not yet. Not quite." My men arrived. "Gopal, Hakim, take these two somewhere and ask them why they were snooping." They were Narayan's cronies, the only two who could ride. He'd probably sent them along to keep an eye on things. Swan got up and leaned against Mather's leg. "You don't have to twist no arms to find that out. Been some wild rumors lately. You've got Ja jumpy as a cat in a kennel."
"Oh?"
"Things were going his way. He got back from Dejagore before anybody else. Only bad luck put the Radisha at Goja before him. She closed the ford. He still figured he had the world by the oysters. Then here comes word somebody's kicked the feathers off a gang of the Shadow Master's boys. Right behind comes a rumor that it was you. You not being dead don't look so good for Ja's ambitions. The company picked up a lot of respect putting it together so fast. Made all those priests look like conniving, selfish jerks." Blade chuckled. Mather said,
"You collected some of that respect, being a woman and having everybody know how much you had to do with it falling together."
He looked me in the eye.
"But being a woman is going to be a handicap now."
"I've been on my own before, Mather. And I hadn't been happy a moment. But happiness is a fleeting creature. It's no birthright. Not anything I expect, but something I accept when I stumble into it.
Meantime, power will do nicely."
"And Ja has liabilities. He's vulnerable. I have 1,000 men over there. Everyone will tell you Ja ran out on us at Dejagore."
"We would have won if it wasn't for him."
Swan surprised me. "We watched the battle. We saw. So did a lot of men who've come in. Even some of Ja's own men admit it."
"A liability," Mather said. "But it's not going to undo him."
Gopal reminded me that 3 Shadar had escaped. True. And they would fly straight to their master, who was sure to make a move. But I doubted he'd do it right away. He was a vacillator. He'd worry a while before committing himself. "Back to camp, Swan. Come, Gopal, bring the prisoners." I rode ahead as hard as the stallion could carry me.
"Sound the alarm on the recall,"
I told the soldiers at the north gate. "Narayan! Ram!" They came running. Narayan gasped,
"What is it, mistress?"
We're pulling out. Right now. Forced march. Get the men ready. Let the horses carry most of the load. Make sure each man carries food. We won't stop for meals. Move! They scooted. It was mid-afternoon. Goja was 40 miles away, a 10-hour jaunt if everyone kept the pace. If the night wasn't too dark. It shouldn't be if the sky stayed clear. There'd be a quarter moon rising an hour after sunset. Not a lot of light, but maybe enough. The horns that we'd taken from the Shadowmaster's cavalry kept sounding recall. The pickets came running. The gang I'd left up the road arrived. Swan and Mather were impressed by the chaos. Mather said,
"You've taught well."
"I think so."
"What are you fixing to do?"
Swan asked. "Take charge at Goja before Jacques can react." He groaned.
"You have a problem with that?"
"Only that we just got finished riding down here. 40 more miles and I won't have a spine left."
"So walk. Sindhu, come here."
I took the wide man aside, gave him instructions. He left smiling, gathered 2 dozen men with strong stomachs, mostly his cronies, and crossed the creek. I sent another man to round up the poles we used for practice pikes and spears. Swan asked,
"You mind if we get something to eat?"
"Help yourself.
Then find me. I want to talk to you."
"Idiot."
He gave me a big nervous smile. I didn't need to be a mind reader to get what was going on in the back of his head. The troops got it together faster than I expected. They had the word, Goja, straight through. I still had a serious problem, lack of a command structure. I had solid squads, and the squad leaders by tens had picked company commanders, but none of those had had more than a few days' practice, and neither of my formally organized battalions had anyone in charge.
"Mather."
He set his foot aside.
"Ma'am, you strike me as a responsible man.
Also, you have field experience and a reputation. I have 2 battalions of 400 men, but no commanders. My man Narayan can muddle through with 1 if I keep him out of trouble. I need somebody to handle the other. A known hero would be perfect, if I thought he wouldn't work against me."
Mather looked me in the eye for several seconds.
"I work for the Radisha. I couldn't."
"I could."
I turned. That was Blade. Smoke had a squeaking fit. Blade grinned, the first I'd seen him do so.
"I don't owe you anything, little man."
He turned to Swan.
"What did I say? Ain't over yet."
Something flickered across Swan's face. He wasn't happy.
"You're putting us in a bad spot, Blade."
"You putting yourself there, Swan. You said it. What kind of people they are. Soon as they got what they want, they're going to stick it in you. That right, wizard? Like you done the Black Company?"
Smoke staggered. He would have been dead if he'd had a bad heart. He looked like he expected me to roast him. I smiled. I'd let him stew a little first.
"I'll accept your offer, Blade. Come meet your 100 leaders.
Once we were out of earshot of the others, I asked, "What did you mean by that remark?"
"Less than it sounded. The wizard, the Radisha, the Prabhrindra. They hurt you more by deceit than treachery. They withheld information. I can't tell you what. I don't know. They thought we were spies you sent ahead. But I can tell you, they never meant to keep their agreement. For some reason, they don't want you to get to Katavar."
Katavar? Croker's mystery destination, the place the Black Company had originated. For 400 years, the company moved northward slowly, in the service of various princes, till it came into mine, then of my enemies, and was reduced to a handful of men. After the battle in the Barrowland, Croker turned back south with fewer followers